This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, some say a crooked judge is getting off the hook. We'll hear about that. A Republican congressman is crying out against foreign aid-funded terrorists. And we'll also hear about UT's efforts to redefine manliness. We'll pick up with part two of my interview with Empowered Texans Board Chairman Tim Dunn on the biblical roots of self-governance. And we'll close with a commentary from Ross Kessig. Welcome back to another week of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. We'll get started by going up to the Metroplex to talk with Aaron Anderson about a big story up there. A judge who was being prosecuted for election fraud, forging signatures to get on the ballot. A lot of people saying he's getting off the hook. Tell us about it.
That's right, Tony. Tarrant County Justice of the Peace, Russ Casey, pleaded guilty to submitting ballot petitions with forged signatures on them, and that's a state jail felony. Judges in Texas need to get 250 signatures on a petition each time they run for office.
In order to get on the ballot.
Should be easy enough, but Casey signed off on petitions that had obviously forged signatures that the voters themselves testified to were not their own. And instead of being jailed like some other recent voter fraud convictees have been, Casey got a probated sentence and at least was forced out of office.
Yeah, so the good news is that this crooked judge is leaving the bench, is out of office, is taking a guilty conviction. You know, so that's all good news. But a lot of people are crying foul saying, hey, this is a politically connected fellow who's getting probation, and it's unfair in light of some very aggressive prosecutions of some illegal voting that had gone on up there. A couple of cases involving some ladies who illegally voted and then were sent to prison for a significant amount of time. Can you shed a little light on that?
Yeah, so two women recently in Tarrant County were convicted of voter fraud. One voted while a felon, which is in itself a felony. Another is a non-U.S. citizen who had voted in multiple elections. Both those women were given pretty harsh jail sentences for their crime, as the law allows. Casey, on the other hand, again, a suspended sentence, no jail time for him. And people feel, rightly so, that an elected official, a judge no less, should certainly be held to the very highest standard. And people inside Tarrant County feel there was some inside dealing, a very friendly, favorable deal cut for Casey.
Yeah, well, and some of the claims out there are that, oh, these women were not offered even the opportunity to plea bargain, whereas Casey obviously was allowed to plea bargain. And I don't know if that's, you know, maybe shed a little light on that. But I think I agree with you. You know, here you've got this guy, he's a judge, he should know better. Everybody should know better than to forge signatures, but particularly a judge. And for a guy like this to be caught red-handed, you would think that they would make an example of him, not, you know, make him an example of, you know, what maybe political favoritism will get you.
Absolutely, that's right. And, you know, people expect the highest standards from their elected officials, and this just does not put a lot of confidence in Tarrant County voters that that there is a fair and equal distribution of justice here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate your reporting on it. We'll have to keep an eye on it. You know, obviously, there'll be more of these prosecutions, a lot of investigations going on, but hopefully we see more aggressive prosecution when people are caught doing this. You know, it's not a shame that these ladies were sent to prison for illegal voting. They should be, but this judge ought to have been sent to jail as well. So I appreciate your reporting on that, Aaron.
You bet, Tony.
Next, let's turn to Empowered Texans President Michael Quinn Sullivan. Michael, you've got an article up about a Texas congressman raising alarm bells that some of our foreign aid may be going to fund terrorists. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it really shouldn't surprise us that with the billions and billions that we send overseas as foreign aid, some of it winds up in the hands of bad guys. That's been going on for some time, and it's been a constant concern from both parties have been worried about this.
Sure.
of particular problem, I think, for a lot of us has been what we see the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and their funding of Hamas and their funding of a program that we call Pay to Slay. The Israelis call it Pay to Slay. We're literally the PLO and the Palestinian Authority giving cash payments to terrorists and to the families of terrorists. And so we saw an American actually killed and someone who the terrorist families were then paid.
Yeah, this is a pension. It's basically a PLO pension program for terrorists who kill Israelis and kill Americans and other innocent people. They're being paid by the same people we're giving checks to.
That's right. And so you had this young man, Taylor Force, who is a graduate student at Vanderbilt, who was killed in a terrorist attack back in 2016. Ted Cruz, our junior U.S. senator from Texas, was one of the co-sponsors of the original Taylor Force Act that would put restrictions on money flowing as foreign aid from the United States to the Palestinian Authority. That legislation never moved anywhere, but under the omnibus bill that passed recently and was signed by the president, the language was included in there. So now it's been, less than a month, and John Ratcliffe, a U.S.
congressman from Texas.
Yeah, Texas congressman, has sent a letter, he and some other members of Congress, to the Department of State asking that, one, all dollars be frozen to the PLO and to the Palestinian Authority until the Department of State can promulgate rules and figure out how they're going to enforce this. All money is fungible. This is the problem.
That's right.
Whenever you send a dollar to the Palestinian Authority, and for as long as they are engaging in terrorism, the reality is we're funding terrorists.
That's right.
Is a terrorist.
Yeah, I mean, these dollars are going over as humanitarian aid is the point, but funds are fungible. And if you've got an organization that's giving pensions to terrorists, well, that doesn't matter. This is something I guess we're going to have an eye on Pompeo as Secretary of State, something we need to be watching to see what he does.
Yeah, fortunately, Mike Pompeo has demonstrated as a guy who can both pat his head and rub his tummy at the same time. Not only does he have the problems in North Korea and possibly reduction of problems in North Korea that he's been managing first as the CIA director and now coming in as the Secretary of State, but I think that this is going to be the next big sticky wicket for him to take on. And fortunately, nice to see that John Ratcliffe is leading the charge and demanding that the Department of State do its job.
Yeah, well, this is really interesting. We'll have to keep following up on it and see how it develops and what actions actually take place.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks. Finally, let's turn to Brandon Walton's Capitol Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard. Got an interesting article up about how our state's flagship university, University of Texas at Austin, is redefining masculinity to include, wearing a dress.
Yeah, so the University of Texas at Austin gained quite a bit of attention on social media recently for a new program they have. It's called Masculine UT.
Or as we've been joking, maybe masculine nut.
Yeah,
kind of nutty.
Essentially, the purpose of the program is to expand the definition, their words, of masculinity. And they've done this kind of the most prominent way is this new poster series. Okay,
yeah, they're putting these posters up all over campus. Yeah.
Yes, essentially pictures of men, wearing dresses, putting on makeup. these things really have to be seen to believe, to be believed.
Up at TexasScorecard.com, yes. EmpireTexans.com, you got the article.
Yeah,
you've got
the posters.
Yeah, you're going to want to go see the posters. So they're doing this campaign and trying to, I'd say all this leftist kind of social engineering, wanting to redefine what, basic concept, masculinity, into, basically saying, well, conventional masculinity is bad. We're going to redefine this, and that now includes, the guy's crying, and there's the guy, there's a person with who wears a dress and makeup.
Yes.
And then there's a woman
in another one, which is really, really expanding the definition of masculinity now to include women.
To include femininity, apparently.
Yeah. Now, as bizarre and funny as all this is, really, it's the big thing it's gotten the attention for is basically it's been treating masculinity, and we've seen this kind of in the last couple years, especially in college campuses and liberal communities, treating masculinity like a mental illness.
Like a mental disease, yeah. Yeah. Well, and that was the big protest. So that was, you know, kind of the narrative over the weekend as this story got coverage was, you know, okay, not only are you doing this silly gender-bending propaganda campaign, but you're treating traditional masculinity, manliness, as a mental disorder. And the university came out and they say, oh, no, 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 no. We're not treating it as a mental illness.
Absolutely not. Yeah, they say that's not at all what we're trying to do. A few sentences down in this statement.
they come in and say, well, the Masculine UT program, of course, housed in the mental health center for the university. And a couple paragraphs later, oh, we're funded through this funding from the Board of Regents for, you know, mental health.
Right.
So it's so much not a mental health issue that it's housed at the mental health center and paid for with mental health dollars. So.
Exactly. And of course, a lot of state funding goes to the state universities, especially UT Austin. When in 2019, you know, next year when the legislature reconvenes, I mean, these are the things they're going to have to consider when they're looking at the budget and looking at how much they're going to fund higher education. Is this what tax dollars really need to be going to? Yeah,
I think what we're seeing here is the wackiness of the liberal academy is boiling over into public view. And I think that's not going to be very good for the university when it's wanting to go and get more tax dollars. I think taxpayers are probably going to say, maybe not so.
We'll be watching it.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Next, we'll pick up where we left off last week with part two of my interview in Jerusalem with Empower Texans Board Chairman Tim Dunn on the biblical roots of self-governance.
Now, so we're talking here about the biblical stories, right? The stories we learn. We read the Bible, and we learn about a plan from God, this lesson. In the context of the nation of Israel, you know, this is 3,500 years ago to 3,000 years, a long time ago. And we see these lessons here. I guess a couple of questions that I think a critic might ask is, you know, aren't these just myths, right? Isn't this just aren't these just myths that are written down? Is there really any real evidence that these things ever even happened? Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen a bit of that as we've been here in Israel, that it is, you know, these are real events based in real places.
It's hard to refute that they're real events.
And then how do these lessons actually apply to the modern world? But first, let's talk about that. You know, this is real stuff. I mean, from Tel Dan to the Dead Sea, you find to the yeah. find the Dead Sea, you've seen the Dead Scrolls to where they find references to King David. Mm-hmm. These are real places and real stories and real things that happen that were written down of, you know, for our benefit.
There's between the vast number of texts that exist for the Bible, which is many times more than any other text that we have, and the proximity to the original authorship, very little doubt that the Bible is what was written. The events that happened have been so widely collaborated that it's been criticized many years. There's no Hittites. There's no they found the Hittites. But there's no. What are the other things? There's no gate at Dan. They uncovered the gate at Dan.
Yeah. So and find it specifically there a reference to this royal house. This, you know, David and his.
And they found the stone. Yeah. There's no real David, and they found a stone. So it's vast amount of collaboration that's happened, but you know, there's no proof, obviously, that God talked to people.
Right.
Or that the miracles happen as evidence. Now, there's no doubt that the people came from Egypt, and they got out somehow.
Right.
Okay, and there's no logical explanation why that would be. You don't chase your slaves away. Okay, so circumstantially, it all makes a lot of sense. But there's still an element of faith. You know, God has put us in this world where if you want not to believe, you don't have to. You can choose not to believe, okay? He's veiled himself from us to some extent. There will be a time when his presence is clear and that nobody has the opportunity to say there's no God because his presence will be compelling, right? But during this time period, you can choose not to believe if you want to, but if you just look at the evidence, it happened. But then the question is, well, are those principles applicable to us?
Right.
Okay. Well, and you can say, well, just look. You have a self-governing nation, America, and look at to the extent that we are self-governing, the blessings have been unbelievable.
And we see that in self-governance of, you know, people volunteering to run for office, volunteering to work the neighborhood campaign, volunteering for social organizations, and, you know, stepping up to, you know, from anything, from serving in government to helping in a soup kitchen.
And well, when you have the businesses that are competing to serve as opposed to businesses that are getting monopolies from the government, right?
Right.
Okay, so vast blessings. And when we have strayed from self-governance, horrific, horrific results. Okay, all men are created equal. That's what the Declaration said. But it wasn't applied to the African immigrants, you know, the African slaves.
Right.
That was not applied.
Yeah, and it took
initially. Initially, 7 years of servitude, and then you were free. And then some cronies went and got legislation passed in the States.
Sure.
And cronyism is what gave us slavery. And then it became a big economic interest with lobbyists, and then it became, a government-protected industry, and that gave us the Civil War, 500,000 deaths. Okay,
right.
So when we stray from self-governance, that's what you get. You get death. You get coercion. You get division. And when you, it's self-governance is a form of love. I mean, when love is when you choose to serve someone else. Okay, and so in a real sense, a true market economy where there's no coercion. That is a love economy.
Right.
Okay, because I serve you. And think about it, the restaurants people love to go to are the one with the fantastic service, right?
Correct, yes.
And if you have a law that says you have to go to Joe's Diner, people would resent that. And the service would be bad.
So applying these principles to modern life, you know, as we were at the Sea of Galilee and we're there, we're seeing this place that Jesus is placed into 2,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
It's amazing these factions, all of these factions from mm-hmm. Hellenic Greek influences where you kind of, as we've said, it's kind of a pick your own God. There's mm-hmm. a God of war, a God of wisdom, a God of love, a God of sex, a God of drinking contests.
You just pay the price and you get what you want, supposedly.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so you have this setting there. You have Roman legions. You have, mm-hmm. and then in the Jewish elements, you have King Herod's, you know, cronies, followers, Herodians,
right.
who are compromising with the Romans
yeah.
to maintain their own segment of power. You have Pharisees who are, saying the right things, but then not following through in their actions. You have the zealots. There are these guys who want to go to war with Rome and
yeah.
fight, you know, and they fight and die, and they're kind of willing to lay it all on the line, but they're not necessarily facing the right way.
They're willing to lay it on the line, but for prideful reasons.
For prideful.
Because they're serving, yeah.
It's interesting as we've explored all of these elements, all going astray in their different mm-hmm. ways, And Jesus Christ coming into this environment, this very small environment with all of these factions, and showing these people the correct way to live and to treat others. How applicable that is in many ways to what we see in the modern world.
Yeah, and I might just say, you know, this what Tony's talking about, it's the Sea of Galilee. It's only about maybe 10 miles long and 5 miles wide or something like that.
Right.
I mean, maybe it's 20 and 10, I don't know, but it's not that big.
It's a lake.
It's a lake, and it's surrounded by hills. And Jesus chose as his capital city, or his headquarters city, Capernaum, which is on the north shore.
Right.
And there's three other fishing villages up there that we visited, two of them, Chorazim and Magdala.
And Mary Magdala.
And then another one, Bethsaida. We drove by it. We didn't go visit it. So these Jewish fishing villages had people in there that really believed the Bible and really professed the Bible, but Jesus was of that group. Okay,
right.
He believed the Bible was true.
These should have been. These were his people.
Should have been his. These are the people he talked to the most sternly, because his main message to them was, his main message to the Pharisees was you're not serving the people. You're taking advantage of them. And so repent. And of course, that didn't go over too well. And they ended up making an alliance with the other two groups that they hated, right? Who were the other two groups? The Herodians were Jews, and that would be representative of the people in Tiberias on the western shore.
Right.
And they said, let's just get along with the Romans. I mean, these guys are powerful man killers, right? Let's just get along with them. And Jesus wouldn't even talk to Herod. You know, this is Herod's son, Herod Antipas, Herod the great builder's son, Herod Antipas. He wouldn't even talk to him. He called him that fox. And generally, the Jews wouldn't even go in that city because it was a pagan city. But they end up cooperating with them to get rid of Jesus. And then on the eastern shore, you've got a Decapolis city called Hippus or Sesita, depending on what language you want to use. The Roman 10th Legion is headquartered there. And their symbol is a pig, ironically enough. And that's just below that city on the slopes. There's where the 2,000 pigs were that ran into the sea.
Yeah, where Jesus drives the demon into the pigs, and the demons into the pigs, the pigs run off into the Sea of Galilee.
The reason there's pigs there is because there's a Greek city up the slope where the Roman 10th Legion is. Romans are happy to eat bacon. The Jews don't eat bacon, okay? And there you got Rome, and the reason they're there is because just up the valley 5 miles is Gamla, which is the headquarters city of the Zealots. Okay, so you got Jesus, of course, had one guy who's Simon the Zealot. He's an official member of the Zealots, but all the other guys, they're Zealot sympathizers. They want Rome out. Okay, and so when Jesus then comes to Jerusalem on his last days, he goes before Herod, who represents the Herodians. He's delivered by the Pharisees, and they make alliance with Pilate, and the one of the three that wants to release him is Pilate of Rome.
Right, right.
And he says, I find no fault in this man. And he intends to release him. And then the Jews, the Pharisees, the guys who are supposed to be his people say, we have no king but Caesar, which according to their own law is blasphemy. And they had convicted Jesus of blasphemy.
Right.
Okay? So you can't get any more ironic than this. The three people who can't stand each other, the one thing they can agree on is get rid of Jesus. Now, why? It's because he stood there on that shore and said, blessed are the peacemakers, okay, for there shall be the kingdom of God. Blessed are the poor in spirit, okay? So you've got the Herodians, they're not poor in spirit. They're in it for themselves. Well,
right.
What compromises do I have to make to get what I want? There's nothing poor in spirit about Rome.
Right.
If you disagree with Rome, they crush you.
Correct.
The Pharisees should have known better, but they were proud in spirit. Okay? And to each one of those guys, to the Herodians, peace means get along with Rome, compromise. To Rome means do what we say or we'll crush you. The Pharisees, peace is a religious concept, follow our rules. Well, no, Jesus said, no, none of that. It starts in your heart and the way you treat others. Let me show you. I'll go have dinner with the sinners.
We'll be back next week with a third and final part of my interview with Tim Dunn from Jerusalem.
Have you heard about the Texas Torchbearers Program? It's a program that makes activism fun and exciting. You can sign up at texastorchbearers.com. There, you can learn about the easiest and most effective ways to engage your government officials to hold them accountable. As a Texas Torchbearer, you can earn cool prizes like an awesome pair of custom-fit cowboy boots with the Texas Torchbearer logo on it, or even a beautiful custom-engraved 9mm Glock handgun. Sign up today at TexasTorchbearers.com.
In this week's commentary, Ross Kessig ponders why Republicans let Democrats control their local elections.
What if I told you that Texans pay the fourth highest property tax rates in the nation? Now imagine if the most likely place for a Democrat to win an election in Texas was for an office that controlled your property taxes. Would that frighten you? It should. Unfortunately, this isn't a hypothetical. With this week's Texas Scorecard radio commentary, I'm Ross Kessig. Government goes to those who show up, and in the races that determine your property taxes, Republican voters are in the minority. It's the most underreported crisis facing Texas taxpayers, and it's a crisis largely ignored by the Republican Party. The most conservative voting bloc of Republicans don't vote in local elections. That's partially because most local races in Texas are decided on May 5th, rather than in November. So while city council and school boards control 80% of your property tax bill, the overwhelming majority of Republicans don't vote in these races. Think about it this way. The Republican primary voters who vote in March every other year pick the Republican candidates who run for governor, lieutenant governor, every statewide office, and every seat in the Texas legislature. And because a majority of Texas voters lean Republican, Republican candidates often go on to beat Democrats. So the question for voters in most state-level races is not whether or not to vote Republican, but rather, what type of Republican are they going to elect? But the conservative voters who picked Governor Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Attorney General Ken Paxton, and who gave Republicans a two-thirds majority in the Texas legislature are skipping over city and school board races. Republicans are conceding those seats to liberal Democrats. Democrats are winning city council and school board races all over the state, especially in conservative suburbs like Frisco and in right-leaning urban cities like Arlington, Fort Worth, and Houston. The law treats these races as, quote, nonpartisan, end quote, meaning the candidates who run don't declare a party affiliation. But that doesn't stop the Democrat Party from endorsing in these races, while the Republican Party doesn't. Local officials tax and spend, they issue debt, they regulate businesses, and in the case of school boards, they control the education of more than 5 million Texas children. If more Republicans voted in May, like they do in March or November, Democrats wouldn't be running our cities and schools. Of course, state lawmakers could abolish May elections altogether and require that local offices be on the November ballot. But that would require a majority of Republican lawmakers to pass legislation that would upset the liberal local government lobby class and public sector unions run by school superintendents and city managers. And so for now, taxpayers must rely upon Republicans to care about local races, just like the Democrats do, and start showing up on May 5th. Government goes to those who show up. And when Republicans don't, the Democrats win, and property taxpayers lose. I'm Ross Kessig with the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Well, we've reached the end of the program. Join us back here next week for the third and final part of my interview with Empower Texans Board Chairman Tim Dunn on the biblical roots of self-governance. If you missed part one, you can always check that out and other programs at the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast available on iTunes. See you next week.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.